Madeline Vianney, 1876 to 1975, internship 1887 to 1893, premier 1893 to 1898. In London, doing reproductions of Paris couture 1898 to 1901. Technician back in Paris, 1902 to 1906. Modeliste, 1906 to 1912. Haute couture, 1912 to 1939. I'm wearing this jacket. No darts, tucks back here. No facings, no lining, no gussets. Simple. Vianney became a technician for the Haute Couture House of the Callosers in 1902. Madame Gerbet, the designer of the house, asked Vianney to develop a similar cut to the Japanese kimono sleeve. Vianney eliminated the shoulder seam and extended the bodice over the shoulder's crepe, the first urban kimono sleeve where the sleeves, front and back bodice were all in one piece. By 1912, when Vianney opened her house at Rue de Rivoli, she was using the wooden half-scale articulated artist form on which to drape her new creations. I was often asked why Vianney used this form. The sleeves on this dress explains that well, as this arm would have to be raised to drape the elbow as well as the underarm. One would have trouble even today draping that sleeve with our current dress forms. Even the remainder of the torso was better served with this form than our own garment industry forms, as the dress on the left has a tucked midriff to fit. These cuts, extensions, and geometric shapes would expand further when Vianney adapted her post-war philosophy. She explained her goal in terms of this art. Quote, the couturier should be a geometrician, for the human body makes geometrical figures to which the material should correspond. Sorry. A 1917 wrap dress was composed of 11 parts using flat pattern. There were two pieces for the skirt, the train, three pieces for the bow, another three for the bodice, and two for the sash. When wrapped and tied, the front is forced into an angle, creating a halter neckline, a V&A innovation. This dress, while the innovation was probably achieved through draping, is like earlier dresses between 1912 and 1914, were planned by traditional pattern drafting, orthogonal projection. Orthogonal projection is the use of height and width on half of the body to produce two-dimensional patterns. It becomes three-dimensional only when transferred to fabric and joined. Vianney, being a technician, would have known this pattern process well. This system reduces clothing to sections of fabric to cover sections of the body, fronts, backs, bodices, torsos, arms, and legs. The fabric sections, joined by seams, cover the desired sections of the body, a method used today just as it was in Vianney's time. As she used to say, but the body doesn't have seams. As Vianney reasoned earlier about applying the cloth to the body made up of geometric shapes. This 1918-19 pattern was created after the war when Vianney reopened her business. This is one of the first dresses that takes advantage of what she had learned about the bias. It is comprised of four squares cut on the grain and hung on the bias, then paired. Because they will be joined on the buyer's direction, they had to be hand-stitched. Once the pieces are sewn, it leaves excess fabric in the form of jabots on either side. A pair covers the front and another the back. Each remaining joined seam is then at the sides. This part is best worked out with flat pattern, while the remainder is best formed by draping. Fitted to the form, the apices are placed above each shoulder and the neckline shaped. Slight adjustments are made for fitting the armholes and the hemline. The apices are placed above each shoulder and the neckline shaped, and slight adjustments are made for fitting the armholes, possibly inspired by the Greek peplos, before joining to form the shoulder seams. One side of each pair is twisted. V&A used this innovation to allow another fabric to cover the shape of the bust and subtract excess cloth to fit the smaller shoulder planes. V&A could have met the futurist artist Ernesto Michaelis, a.k.a. Thayet, during her visit to Italy during the early war years. He came to Paris in 1918 as an art student and illustrated V&A's work for the Gazette de Bon Ton. Thayet was very influential on the early V&A work, particularly at this time, both with dynamic symmetry and the goal of an economy of cut. Dynamic symmetry was a system of mathematics first conceived in ancient Greece for proportioning of their temple architecture. Proportions were achieved through the diagonal of a rectangle, square, or half square. V&A learned the ancient Greek method at proportion and adapted these principles. The diagonal of a square was used for proportioning certain surface decorations. Lesage adapted the logarithms for V&A's appliques and embroidery decorations. I believe this firm used these logarithms long after V&A retired. This pattern is comprised of four rectangle pieces, two of one shape, one in the front and one in the back, and two parts that fit under the arms to form the sides. It is sleeveless and belted, and the Greek-inspired cowl neckline falls on the bias and is sheer to cover the shoulders. All seam parts are cut on the grain, and once joined and placed on the body, would spiral around the body at a 45-degree angle. This would replace the traditional 90-degree hang of the grain of textiles and clothing heretofore. The dress hangs on the bias. The dress is comprised of two shapes and four parts, plus a sash. Balance between positive and negative surface designs was often found in the selection placement of textiles during V&A's career. Opaque and transparent fabric, dull alternating with shiny surfaces, alternating directions of the nap of velvets, or contrasting colors. The possibility was enhanced by the advancement of textile technology during the war. Large vats were needed for dyeing the size of the pieces woven for uniforms. Vat dyeing was developed that allowed the twisting of fibers before weaving, resulted in the availability of several new crepe weaves after the war that varied in depth and surfaces. Textiles are anisotropic, the Greek word for different in different directions. The warp and weft threads are stable when woven. The bias, the diagonal between warp and weft, is not. When strained, the bias can either contract or stretch. Exploiting the bias, V&A created designs that could be put on over the head like a sweater. This was most convenient as zippers in the late teens and 20s were not yet used as closures in fashion. Circular forms were particularly found in Greek pottery. That inspired V&A. two quadrants, one for the front body and one for the back, placed with the apex of the neckline at the neckline, makes the need to reduce the excess at the upper body unnecessary because the shape radiates, it fits the larger area from the waist down as well. To shape the neckline, front and back end, each is spread, slashed, tucked, and the front and back joined to form shoulder seams. The self-sash, when tied at the waist, creates a blouson style. V&A would further develop both quadrant shapes and slashing. And I'm going to insert one thing, that this happened to be one of her best sellers when it came out. And I think 12 women wore the same dress to the same party, and they were not too happy. Okay, quoting V&A, simplicity is what is most difficult in the world. It's the last stage of experience and the first effort of the genius. There are three parts to this dress. Proportion played a key role in this design, as V&A said. Why should waist be high? Oh, I think I missed one. Okay. Oh, yes, I see. This dress was made from one piece. It is wrapped and extended in the back to overlap and close at each side. Quadrant-shaped extensions are looped into ellipses and inserted into horizontal slashes above the lowered waistline to simulate a cape. The side fronts are slashed down to the upper hip to allow a cowl neckline to be draped. Then triangle-shaped gussets are cut from the excess, removed from the back, are inserted and stitched into the slash sides so as to cover the bust planes. A trompe-l'oeil beaded embroidered belt is applied at the upper hip below the pseudo-cape to emphasize the silhouette. A proportion played a key role in this design. As V&A said, why should waist be high one season and low the next? A waistline should suit the wearer's proportion. I was the first to lower waistlines to suit my own proportions. Now when I see women in bodices that are longer than their skirts, I am ashamed to think that that may be my fault. As V&A entered the late 1920s, her earlier use of geometrical shapes to cover planes of the body would be intensified. The tubular silhouette was gradually moving in towards a more fitted body with longer, fuller skirts. The former was the development of V&A's anatomical cut, a title invented by Byers. In this transitional style, can we find, make sure. In this transitional style can be found V&A's use of mismatched quadrants. Placing the bias at the hip further contribute to flow when worn. Each apices was used. The front was draped, easing in enough to cover the bust, and what remained a modest cowl neckline. The back V neckline was cut on the grain line. As V&A said, I have proved there is nothing more graceful than the sight of material hanging freely from the body. I've attempted to create an element of balance in my material so the lines of the dresses are not marred by any movement but emphasized. This leaves the side waist, both front and back, uncovered. The body planes for that space contains a triangle for the waist up and another the waist down. Combined at the common side, they form a diamond shape. A diamond shape was cut to fill the void. Weighting the bias was one of V&A's methods of controlling the distortion of bias hangout. It was also a preparation for cutting on the bias, as she said of the process, now the bias has done its work. The fabric is cut and or folded into quadrants. The apex is pinned to the wall first, then the remainder smoothed out and flattened. pinning that to the wall on either side. Weights are attached along the bottom edge for a period of time to force the bias to stretch in any susceptible area. The skirt, all right, I don't have the other one. The skirt has a half circle back skirt combined with a front quadrant, placing the seams on a princess line in front. On taking this pattern, it was clear the skirt parts had obviously been given the weighted treatment, particularly the back, that is totally cut on the bias direction. While the bodice hangs on the bias, most of the seams are cut on or near the grain. The neckline is another V&A's innovation known at that time as the V&A décolletage. The back bodice extended to serve as an insertion for the slash into the center back skirt waistline. The skirt slash in the bodice insertion results in a short train, as you can see there. This 1935 pattern is a traditional flared skirt cut on the bias. The bodice is formed from a bias cut rectangle that is slashed, twisted, looped, and wrapped and tied. I think I have the wrong one here. No, all right. Oh, here we are. I skipped a page, that's what. To control the hangout of the circular cut skirts at the hemline, generally an even distribution and size of the ripples are desired. The goal is to place an equal number of yarns in each ripple. While the insertions hang from the waistline, the joined slashed areas move the grain to hang on an angle. This puts the points of hanging on the bias direction. This is easier accomplished at the waistline if that is on the bias. Thus, as in patterns 12 and 15, waistlines that are on the grain are slashed and gussets inserted. Pattern 12 is comprised of one quadrant, while pattern 15, we call a skirt pant, is comprised of three quarters of a circle. It is an example of V&A's extension of a pattern part and was one of V&A's personal gowns. As she labeled a skirt pant. This 1935 pattern is a traditional flared skirt cut on the bias. The bodice is formed from a bias cut rectangle that is slashed, twisted, looped, wrapped, and tied. This pattern is formed from three parts. The bias cut rectangular part was another example of V&A's use of extensions. The bodice's elongated rectangle is slashed down the center at both ends with a small measure left intact. The long ends are looped back and stitched, the purpose to create more weight. The short ends are looped back and stitched to create a tunnel for the long loops to be threaded. Before that happens, the sides are joined to the back skirt extension, with one side being twisted over the head to place the entire rectangular piece on the face side. After threading, the long loop sides are wrapped around the body and finally tied. All this accomplished from a single rectangle of fabric, certainly emulating the ancient Greeks. This 1918 cape is Leda's Art Decoratives Model 32, an example of V&A's extension of grain cut hung parts. One is the collar, which is highly decorated on its outer side. There is the back part that would have been extended on either side to cover each side of the front if the fabric were wider. Instead, another piece was stitched to each side of the back, leaving then open while covering the entire body. Each of these parts are extended to include their lining. Each side is folded to indicate the front and the fold slashed and finished for the armhole. The front is joined to the back after allowing excess to fall over the breast and an overlap in the center back for entrance. The cape actually becomes a coat. And I have the 12. This is my favorite thing. I'm going to make it one day.
Okay. Where do I go? This way?
Put that on there. Oh, this is something special. This is a photograph of V&A taken by Thayat when he first met her. Isn't it lovely? I think it's great. It was clear that this present pattern that you saw could only be achieved through draping, considering all the factors only V&A's half-scale artist mannequin that she likely used for her second kimono sleeve pattern would work, because of the need for draping, it would have to rotate. Likely because V&A played the piano, she chose a revolving piano bench on which to mount it that enabled the cloth to spiral naturally around the form. In adapting the same method the potters used to create the vases, V&A invented a revolutionary method of pattern draping and dressmaking that resulted in timeless designs that fit the female body. Oh, I'm back to it. While designers may envision new styles in a number of ways, it is the technician who translates the idea into reality. In the fashion world, the technician must accomplish this through pattern that is truthful to the envisioned new style. It follows a technician must be proficient in dressmaking and or tailoring and in pattern making.